Good morning, Your Honors. Kenneth Nackbar, Morris Nichols, here on behalf of the appellant individual defendants. With me and arguing on our behalf today is Mark Perry of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. Also from Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher are Jeff Wayne, Jeffrey Reed, and Wayne Smith. And finally, William Scharf of Allergan, Inc. is also in the courtroom. Last but not least, Jeremy Anderson from Fish & Richardson, who represents the company. Thank you, Your Honors.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your
Honor. May it please the court, I rise briefly. I will be making the argument today on behalf of the plaintiffs below, the appellees here today, but I rise to introduce my colleague at my table, Jeff Golan from Barrick Rodas, Lisa Lamb, also with Barrick Rodas, Scott Shepard with Shepard Finkelman, and my associate, Mr. Tucker.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just before you begin, for those of you who saw the earlier argument, I'm going to apologize in advance if I cough through your argument. Everybody reads all inferences into everything my colleagues say here. The cost should bear no inference whatsoever about the quality of your argument or the substance. I'm just suffering a bit, and I apologize for any distraction that may cause to any of you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this is a case about full faith and credit, about federalism, about the respect afforded courts in our system of multiple sovereigns when one renders a judgment before the other. This court long ago held in the Iowa-Wisconsin case that the courts of the state of Delaware must give the judgments of coordinate courts, including federal courts, the same, quote, sanctity and effect, end quote, as the rendering court would give its own judgment. That principle, the full faith and credit principle, applies even if the Delaware courts disagree with the first court's judgment, because full faith and credit means exactly what it says, full faith and credit. There is no collateral attack permitted in the second court. That has been established since the Thompson case in this court, and from even before that in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Ninth Circuit has an appeal pending of the California judgment. That court sits to correct any errors made by Judge Carter, whether of Delaware law or otherwise. This court sits not to review the correctness of the California court's judgment, but rather whether Vice Chancellor Laster was required to apply that judgment in this case. The short answer, Your Honor, is the California judgment is preclusive in Delaware. It is an established principle of Delaware law, and for that matter of federal common law, that the preclusive effect of the judgment is determined by the law of the rendering court. Where the rendering court is a federal court, under federal common law as articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court in Semtec, this court and all courts of the second court, in other words, looks to the law of the underlying state, in this case, California.
And what will happen if the Ninth Circuit reverses the federal court?
Your Honor, if the Ninth Circuit reverses the federal court on demand futility, then the California case will proceed. We will have the situation that we had at the outset of this litigation, which is all too frequent in derivative litigation, where we have two cases running in parallel. One would hope the plaintiffs would coordinate with one another. I'd like to point out that we have in this case an intervener, UFCW, the 220 filer, was not the original plaintiff in either Delaware or California. That plaintiff elected to intervene in Delaware. It elected not to intervene in California, even though it obviously could have. And at the time it intervened in Delaware, it told Vice Chancellor Laster, and this is a quote from page A81 of the appendix, quote, collateral estoppel will bar relitigation of demand futility, where one derivative suit was dismissed with prejudice and a second shareholder plaintiff subsequently files similar claims against the same set of defendants in another court. So it was no mystery to these plaintiffs what would happen if the California court got to judgment first, and everyone was on notice of both cases.
Let me try my question again. If you prevail in the appeal you're arguing today, and we say the Court of Chancery should not have entered a ruling at all. And that's the end of the Chancery case in Delaware. And then the Ninth Circuit reverses the federal court in California. What are the implications?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I misunderstood the timing. The right answer in Delaware is the case should be dismissed with prejudice on the grounds of collateral estoppel. If the Ninth Circuit reverses down the road in the California case, that litigation would then restart as a result of that appellate reversal, and the shareholder in that case could go forward. If either of these shareholders wish to participate in that action, they would have to ask permission from the federal court under Federal Rule 24 to intervene or otherwise participate. So the answer is the Delaware case should be over, however, because the preclusive effect of the California judgment is final. The pending appeal doesn't affect the finality for purposes of collateral estoppel, and therefore the answer is that the Delaware case should be over.
Well, should we wait for the Ninth Circuit to act? Is that prudent?
Your Honor, there's no reason to wait for the Ninth Circuit to act for two reasons. First, the Ninth Circuit will take some time to act, and the case need not be in suspension for that long. Second, the finality of the judgment, I mean, this is a question that arises frequently when two cases go to judgment first. The California case got to judgment first. That judgment is preclusive for collateral estoppel purposes, even though there's a pending judgment. And typically, in the second case, the court does not wait. This court confronted exactly that issue in the Thompson case, for example, where the Pennsylvania District Court judgment was being challenged, that this court afforded a collateral estoppel effect, even though there was the possibility of a future appeal, and the court went out of its way to make the point that until that district court judgment is affected, it's binding and it's preclusive in Delaware, and therefore the right answer as a matter of judicial efficiency and economy would simply be to close out the Delaware matter because the California judgment.
Would there be a Rule 60 motion available to reopen the Delaware case if we address this as you would like us to?
Well, if the Ninth Circuit were to reverse down the road, the Delaware plaintiffs would have to assess their options. They could either move to intervene in California. They could simply acquiesce in the California plaintiff's prosecution of the case. They could ask the Delaware court for relief under Rule 60 to reopen this case. There may be other options available to them. The orderly sequence of events, though, would be to dismiss this case because of the preclusive effect of the judgment and allow the rest of the litigation to proceed. There is no mystery in this case, Your Honor, as to what the rendering court, that is the California court, views as the preclusive effect of its judgments. We have the LaBoyer case from that court, from the Central District of California, squarely ruling on the question. The Delaware plaintiffs don't disagree with that. Vice Chancellor Lasser didn't disagree with that. What the court below said was that LaBoyer is wrong, and it's wrongly decided as a matter of Delaware law. Your Honor, that is the error of which we complain. The preclusive effect of the California judgment turns in no respect on Delaware law. Vice Chancellor.
But I gather your point is that whether or not, the judgment was correctly, that is, the case was correctly decided under Delaware law, the judgment of the California court was final, and that judgment deserved full faith and credit. Period.
Absolutely right, Justice Jacobs. It is not open to a second court. Essentially, the Delaware trial courts don't sit in appellate review of the California federal courts. That's the Ninth Circuit's job, whether or not it's a question of Delaware law. But importantly, it is not a question of Delaware law. It's a question of California law. And Justice Vice Chancellor Lasser said that there were two elements of the collateral estoppel inquiry that were controlled by Delaware law, privity and adequacy of representation. As to privity, he was just wrong, Your Honor. The black-letter law, if I may quote from the Restatement Second of Conflicts, Section 94, which was cited by this court in the Cavalier Oil case, footnote 3, the predecessor was, quote, "What persons are in privity with a party to the judgment is determined by the local law of the state where the judgment was rendered," period, end quote. There's no ambiguity in that. And that is the rule that was applied in every single one of the cases in the line that includes LaBoyer, the most articulate of which are the In Re Sonus Network case from the First Circuit and the Hennick case from New York. Those all recognize that the privity question, that is, whether shareholders are in privity with one another, is determined by the law of the forum state, not by Delaware law. No court has ever invoked the Internal Affairs Doctrine, as Vice Chancellor Lasser did here, and in fact, the Delaware cases before this case, in particular the career education case, recognized the propriety of the federal rule.
I just want to make sure I understand your full faith and credit position. What I hear is that the error from a full faith and credit point of view was not that the Court of Chancery reviewed the judgment under Delaware law or California law, it's that the error was in reviewing that judgment at all under any law.
That is correct, Justice Jacobs. The full faith and credit clause required and allowed Vice Chancellor Lasser to do one inquiry. What preclusive effect would the California judgment have in the California court, in the rendering court? The answer to that required no guesswork, no predictions, not even
enough. California case.
Because of the California case, LaBoyer. And then, therefore, it was Vice Chancellor Laster's obligation in this case under the full faith and credit clause.
So that is your lead argument. Then any argument you have as to whether or not the court was correct in applying Delaware law on the issue of privity or on the issue of adequacy of representation is secondary.
Absolutely.
It's an alternative.
Absolutely right, Your Honor. Right. Our first argument is that it was not even open to the Chancery Court in this case to revisit the California judgment. That's an argument, by the way, that the plaintiffs don't answer in their brief. It's a lead argument in our brief, and it's an argument that they don't respond to in their brief because I think it has no answer. And it is compelled, you know, by the Iowa Wisconsin case, by the Simtek case in the Supreme Court. It is the law. And there's a line of authorities. It is clear, Your Honor, that Vice Chancellor Lasser disagrees with the California with the federal precedents, the Sonus Network line of cases. We get that. There is a line of authority, though, culminating in the Supreme Court's decision in Baker versus General Motors, goes back to Fauntleroy versus Lum, that says that if the second court disagrees with the first court, it still doesn't have the opportunity or the authority to sit in what amounts to appellate review of that first court's decision. And this goes to your question, Justice Jacobs. It simply is not the case that even if the first court's preclusion law is wrong or inconsistent with Delaware law, that the second court has the authority to revisit that question. And that's the full faith and credit problem. Second, then we have these two issues, privity and adequacy of representation, which Vice Chancellor Lasser analyzed under Delaware law. If this court could get over that first full faith and credit hurdle, which we submit is insurmountable, then would come those two questions. Is privity a question of Delaware law? I submit that it is not, for the reason I just indicated, that the restatement of conflicts of laws make clear that that, too, is controlled by the rendering state and that every authority, including career education, recognizes that, and that the logic of those cases should lead to the same privity conclusion, even as a matter of Delaware law, because the question of demand futility, the question whether the board was capable of making an independent determination with respect to the litigation, is one of those issues that in our law, in fairness and justice and equity and right, should be decided only once, rightly or wrongly, but once. Because if we have a court of competent jurisdiction and an adequate plaintiff, which I will turn to next, then we have adjudications in our legal system that solve problems, that allow corporations and shareholders and boards and courts to move on to the next problem. And if futility is not established, that is, if demand is not excused and the case cannot proceed in any court of competent jurisdiction, there is no reason to allow relitigation of that. This court has made that point in the King case. The Court of Chancery has made that point in innumerable cases, that this question, demand futility, allowing relitigation of it is an exercise in futility, if I may use a pun, Your Honor. It is an exercise in waste. It is an exercise in illogic, and it ultimately harms the shareholders of the corporation who have to pay for everything twice.
All right, now turning to the secondary arguments, that is privity and adequacy of representation and whether they are governed by Delaware law. I gather that as to privity, your argument is that no case until this one has ever applied internal affairs. The internal affairs doctrine is a choice of law principle.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That, and there's is there any other argument you have going on the substance of the privity issue?
There's two lead arguments on privity, Your Honor. First is it's a question of California law. It was resolved by LaBoyer. That is consistent with the nine other cases that have looked at this question first under Massachusetts and other laws.
There is privity because the real plaintiff is the corporation.
Therefore, our second argument is that if it is a matter of Delaware law, it is a question of Delaware law that this court has never decided. There is no case holding that shareholders are not in privity for these purposes. No case holding that they are either. We acknowledge that. But that the logic of those other cases, the Sonus Network line of cases, should lead this court, if it has the intent and authority to reach that question, to conclude as a matter of Delaware law that that shareholder privity rule is correct, that it is the case that demand futility is an issue that should be resolved once and only once in a court of competent jurisdiction with an adequate plaintiff. And once it has been decided, it need not be, in fact, should not be litigated again. The rule in this case, the rule adopted by Vice Chancellor Laster, which says that the first adjudication is not binding, guarantees that it will be litigated at least twice in every case, because in every case we will have a Delaware plaintiff and a non-Delaware plaintiff. And we may have a California plaintiff and a Michigan plaintiff and a Massachusetts plaintiff and everything else, but at least we will have two, because the foreign plaintiffs, with the benefit of this rule, essentially can take a free shot, get an advisory opinion. If they win the demand futility motion, then they're off to the races. If they lose, then the Delaware plaintiffs, who will have been proceeding more slowly, presumably, and going under 220, have a roadmap as to how to avoid that previous determination.
So your argument, if I understand it, is number one, that approach that the Court of Chancery took to the privity issue is unprecedented. Number two, it's a bad rule.
Summed it up very well, Your Honor.
All right. Turning to the other issue, that is the other secondary issue, which is adequacy of representation. I understand that one of your arguments is procedural. That is, it was never raised by any party, and no one had a chance to be heard on this presumption that the court adopted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there any other argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
That you're advancing?
Yes, Your Honor. First, what I would call our lead argument on adequacy is adequacy, too, is determined by the law of the rendering court. In other words, that is a question of California law. There is no determination that these plaintiffs were inadequate as a matter of California law or federal due process, which, of course, under Hansberry versus Lee always overrides in representative actions, and therefore that the Court of Chancery's inadequacy determination, which was deliberately, intentionally, expressly, and exclusively rested on Delaware law, whether or not it is right as a matter of Delaware law, has no place here because it is not something that is to be found in California's law. So that, again, it runs into this full faith and credit problem that the rendering court's law provides the rule of decision. The secondary argument on this point, Your Honor, is as to inadequacy, if there is some more overriding or Uber law that is something south of the Constitution but north of what Vice Chancellor Laster did, it is the restatement principle that the Sonus Network Court recited and that every other court has recited, that the representation must be, quote, so grossly deficient as to be apparent to the opposing party, end quote. That is the standard that most of the courts have used. The failure to file a Section 220 demand before filing a shareholder derivative suit is not, quote, so grossly deficient as to be apparent to the opposing party, end quote. In fact, it is something that happens all the time. Vice Chancellor Laster was certainly correct that this court and others have criticized that practice, but this court and others have never said that it is, quote, so grossly deficient as to make a plaintiff inadequate. In fact, I would submit that that ruling, the inadequacy ruling, is inconsistent with King II, this court's decision in King, which allowed the plaintiff to proceed who had first filed the shareholder derivative action without a 220 demand, and then later went back and filed his 220 demand. If his first effort had been inadequate to the level held by the Court of Chancery in this case, the court would have affirmed the Court of Chancery, not reversing it. Of course, this court did reverse the Court of Chancery. And in so doing, the court in King II made clear that while this fast filer issue is a problem, that the use of Section 220 is a problem, it cannot be resolved by the Court of Chancery with bright-line rules, which is what Vice Chancellor Laster did here. Rather, there are other mechanisms available. One is with the parties. The defendants can move to stay one of the other actions. And in fact, in this case, the defendants moved to stay the California action in deference to Delaware, but the California court refused that request. So the defendants had no choice but to litigate in California. The other mechanism for the parties is the intervention process. UFCW intervened in Delaware, but they didn't intervene in California. They could have, and the Delaware plaintiff could have intervened in California. There are some that are available to courts. King II listed three options, none of which was applied here. And some are reserved to the legislature. 19 states, of course, have adopted by statute universal demand requirements, which would solve this problem. The legislature, the General Assembly of Delaware, would have the power to make Section 220 a prerequisite to a shareholder derivative suit, which would be a question of substantive law. But in the absence of such a positive law enactment, it is not inadequate for a shareholder plaintiff to file suit in a derivative case without making a 220 demand. King II holds that. In fact, this court has never suggested otherwise. I see, Your Honors, that I'm eating into my own time. If I may sit down unless you have other questions.
That's your prerogative. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, Pamela Tekelis on behalf of the plaintiffs below, the appellees here today. I'd like to begin with a privity point, Your Honors, unless you would like me to go to some other point first.
No, please do, because one of the questions I was going to ask in between choking was, isn't it privity linked to the first issue very closely by Vice Chancellor Laster? In refusing to give, in effect, full faith and credit, isn't he doing so on the basis that these plaintiffs in Delaware are not bound by what other plaintiffs in California do? Therefore, the decision in California it's not an obligation to give full faith and credit to it because it doesn't affect these plaintiffs.
That was his reasoning below, and I think he went so far as to say that he didn't believe collateral estoppel applied in this instance, but certainly there could be, if he were persuaded by the California opinion, the doctrine of stare decisis.
Well, explain to me how they're linked, because the way the argument was structured that I just heard, it's sort of tiered. You have a first question. If you don't get by the first question, you really don't need to address the rest. And when I read the briefs, I had the at least superficial view, which I call superficial because I always wait until oral argument before I decide anything, that it isn't a preclusive step number one, then and only do you get to step number two, that this privity issue is essential to deciding the first issue, at least as Vice Chancellor Laster sees it. Can you explain that to us?
And I think this is what the court did. I think that he clearly acknowledged that there was this growing body of cases that were basically saying, you know, one plaintiff's dismissal is preclusive to another at the demand stage. And he also acknowledged, though, that he had to apply the collateral estoppel law from California, and I think he used California and federal because they were basically the same. But in doing that, he looked at the element of privity, and he said, to my mind, and I agree with him, to my mind, that's an issue of Delaware law. That's internal affairs doctrine.
Well, the court, the Vice Chancellor could, well, and perhaps properly could have said this is an issue of Delaware law, that is, whether or not there's privity. And I mean, he could also have held that the California court misapplied Delaware law. But wasn't he required as a matter of full faith to then conclude that no matter what I say, the California argument, that is, the California judgment is final, that if there's, I have no power under the federal constitution to review it for substantive correctness, and if there is any remedy, it's in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
I think what he did is he looked at the various elements and concluded that...
I know what he did. I'm asking, how can you reconcile what he did with the dictates of the full faith and credit clause?
Well, the cases that I heard that were articulated here today, the Cavalier case, for instance, was an appraisal case, and in that case, there was no analysis of sub-elements of collateral estoppel or res judicata. The court there basically said, we're going to look to Virginia law to see whether or not we can look at a judgment and say certain claims are preserved for res judicata, others are not. So there wasn't an analysis. I don't think there's an absolute bar just because another court has rendered a decision.
Well, another way to look at what he did would be to acknowledge that the full faith and credit clause has constitutional dimensions. But if you look at the Cayman decision and other decisions, it said the internal affairs doctrine also is a constitutional provision, not simply choice of law. So in reconciling these two competing federal constitutional principles, due process and the internal affairs doctrine and full faith and credit, he came out in favor of due process and the internal affairs doctrine.
Yes. Yes, he did. And my colleague here today said that no court has looked to Delaware law for any element of collateral estoppel. And two courts have. The LaBoyer court looked to Delaware law to determine what was meant by on the merits. And the Sonas case actually looked to Delaware law, and that's at page 64. And it recognized in analyzing the privity element that standing to represent a foreign company, that being Delaware in the case, is governed by the law of the state of incorporation. And that court specifically held that standing to represent the foreign corporation is governed by the laws of the state of incorporation, and Delaware law is in accord with the prevailing rule, including Massachusetts, that the shareholder in a derivative suit represents the company.
But the California court applied Delaware law, correct?
The California court applied Delaware law in looking at demand futility, yes.
Is that judgment, do you agree that judgment is final, the trial court judgment is final for collateral estoppel purposes?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I think probably the court below did too, and I think the court below focused on the element of privity and then the other element, which is an exception to collateral estoppel of adequacy.
So we have the anomalous situation where if there was a Delaware suit that was dismissed and a successive Delaware suit by another shareholder plaintiff, the second suit could go forward. But based on the first suit here starting in California, the second suit in Delaware would be precluded by collateral estoppel.
Correct. And I think to that point, Your Honor, is the King case in this court, where I think it's very clear that the three suggested remedies that the court laid out that the Court of Chancery could resort to was a dismissal with prejudice to the named plaintiff only without leave to amend, and that's certainly contemplated under our Chancery Court Rule 15AAA. The other remedy was deny that person lead plaintiff status. And the third, which gives that same plaintiff another bite at the apple, was, well, if you pay the attorney's fees for the first go-around on this issue, will allow you to get a final chance. And I think King is instructive on that, at least when, as Your Honor says, they're back-to-back successive cases in Delaware. I don't think the court meant that it was preclusive in its remedy.
Well, King was a Section 220 case, wasn't it?
Pardon me?
Wasn't King a Section 220 case?
Yes.
I don't
yes.
understand how it can be instructive when what we have here is an argument that the federal constitution trumps whatever substantive issue of Delaware law the second court believes should apply. And I don't know how you address that in your brief.
Because I can't do that under the federal and the California case.
I'm sorry.
I cannot do that because the King case was based on cases in Delaware and not in another jurisdiction. But I'm just saying it's instructive in terms of Delaware law, and as Justice Holland points out, we have the unusual situation. If we were talking about this situation here today, I'm pretty confident that we'd not be having this argument over privity.
Justice Holland's question is couched in terms of two competing federal constitutional doctrines, correct?
Yes.
Was that tug of war between due process and full faith and credit addressed either by the Court of Chancery or in your brief?
I don't believe it directly was, because I think the opinion below was based on internal affairs doctrine.
Right, as a choice of law.
As a choice of law.
Not as a constitutional doctrine.
Correct.
And you're not arguing that it's a constitutional doctrine, at least on this appeal.
I cannot make that argument. But I do think that what's happened here in the foreign courts that we see, the LaBoyer Court, the Sonis Court in particular, there is a shorthand that has been invoked, and it's unfortunate. It's a shorthand that says, once you bring a suit, you stand in the shoes of the corporation. Everybody is therefore in privity from the very beginning. It totally ignores the dual nature of the derivative action as outlined in this court and by Justice Ridgely, probably most recently in the Shoon case. And I think that's where the court was focused on that.
What we're being told is, if what you said is a correct statement of the Delaware law, there's no privity between shareholders if they don't survive a motion to dismiss. So let's assume that's the Delaware law. And we're being told that under the full faith and credit clause, we can't address that because California says there is privity between the shareholders. Isn't that the argument that's being made?
That's the argument that's being made, and I think that the counter-argument to that is that if the California court had basically the argument on privity was being made as it's being made here today and under Delaware law, just as the court looked to Delaware law to determine, because the issue, what's fascinating about the reliance on the LaBoyer case is it really was focused on the merits, that collateral estoppel element. We then have the shorthand, because it didn't go, it just repeated, everybody stands in the shoes of the company. And that's now become a translation of Delaware law. And I think if the argument had been made to the LaBoyer court that that's not Delaware law, there's no authority,
result. Anyone disagrees with that, but the argument is, even if they got it wrong, for whatever reason, under the full faith and credit clause, the Delaware courts are bound, that under our federal structure of government, Delaware must give full faith and credit to a judgment that's wrong as a matter of, to an issue decided in a judgment that's wrong as a matter of Delaware law. And if the sub-issue really relates to privity, under the restatement, that privity is decided by the law of the other jurisdiction too. So we have these twofold reasons we're hearing why there's nothing a Delaware court can do. And so the question that you need to help us resolve is, how do we get beyond the full faith and credit clause, and how do we get around the fact that even though California may be wrong on privity, that's the law we have to apply?
And I guess the only way you can get around that is start with full faith and credit and do the analysis, does collateral estoppel apply? And that's the question. And looking at the sub-elements, and if allowed to look to the state of incorporation to do that analysis, I think you can avoid full faith and credit. If you're going to take the position that my friends take today, that basically collateral estoppel, you need to look at every sub-element under California law, and that no court has ever looked to Delaware law or the state of incorporation to determine any of those elements, then maybe there is a very preclusive blanket rule, but I don't know why courts bother with the analysis under collateral estoppel and looking at the various elements. Because there have been courts, and there are many courts, and they keep citing to the 10 courts, all around the country, and I think in their brief they go so far to say that all of those 10 courts have looked at the Delaware precept, that being that when you first bring a case, you do not have authority to sue. It's an individual claim. You don't have authority to sue in the name of the company until you get over your 23.1. None of the cases analyzed that precept. None of them. Career Education didn't analyze that. Vice Chancellor Parson wasn't asked to analyze that. The parties came in and said, we give up, we concede. Collateral estoppel applies to our case. What we're upset about, and there was a 220 twist there, but not the one we're talking about today. What we're upset about is we did a 220. People in whatever state it was, I forgot, were provided with a 220. They now have information, but we don't think their complaint is as compelling as ours. And the vice chancellor looked at it and he said, you've conceded collateral estoppel. He did no analysis except the shorthand. You stand in the shoes of the company. And he looked at the two complaints, and he said, I don't see the difference.
The problem I have is that that argument is not a constitutional argument. It may be a statutory argument, it may be a common law argument. And just a footnote, Justice Holland's observation about the force, that is the effect of the full faith and credit clause, is that Delaware can play no role in second-guessing a final judgment of a California court. If there's merit to the argument that privity is an issue that should be determined by the state of incorporation, that's an argument that the losing side in the California case is free to argue in the Ninth Circuit, but not here. And that is the problem. How do we surmount that?
Well, it's a problem because the remedies that I heard proffered today was we could either, having chosen to come to Delaware, committed to stay in Delaware to the court below, that we have a couple of choices. We can run off to California where we believe the issues of Delaware law were decided wrongly and intervene, or we can try and reopen a judgment under Rule 60.
And it's unlikely privity is even going to go to the Ninth Circuit because the issue for the Ninth Circuit is the Delaware demand rule. And the only reason privity comes up is after the Delaware demand rule was construed. So privity's, as the Chief Justice said, tied to collateral estoppel. But privity's not going to be an issue in the Ninth Circuit. The issue in the Ninth Circuit is, was demand excused or not?
I totally agree with that. I don't think they're going to be arguing on our behalf to the Ninth Circuit.
Explain to me again, and I say again because you probably did, and maybe I'm just not getting it, the relationship between the constitutional proposition of full faith and credit, which all of my colleagues have acknowledged is important in this case, and collateral estoppel. Is your position that there can be a judgment in the federal district court in California that would, under the Constitution, be entitled to full faith and credit in Delaware only if the elements of collateral estoppel have been met?
That's my argument. I think you have to meet the elements of collateral estoppel. In every case that is cited to the court, and we only have, the universe is small. We have 9 or 10 cases, maybe we have 11 by now, but it's a very small universe. Every court goes through, even when they're not required, on the issue of privity. And LaBoya, they said, well, we're going to look at on the merits under Delaware law. And then since nobody brought it up, they said, let's go through the others. And they said, privity, oh, there's privity. Everybody stands in the shoes of the company. But there has to be that analysis. Collateral estoppel is part of full faith and credit.
It comes down to whether the vice chancellor could look at the issue of privity independently because of the internal affairs doctrine. Because if he only has to apply collateral estoppel if there's privity, what we're told is he can only look at privity under the restatement through the cases from California. And even if those cases in California were wrong as a matter of Delaware law, he's bound to apply them because it's the California construction of privity that controls, not Delaware. And in this case, the vice chancellor said, well, that can't be the rule. I should, under the internal affairs doctrine, be able to look at privity under Delaware law, not California law.
Right, and I think in support of that, he cites to the restatement of conflicts, I think, Section 304, Court versus Ash, Cayman case that Your Honor previously mentioned, that as a matter when we're talking about relationships among and between directors, stockholders, officers, that those are issues of internal affairs, and that whether or not successive plaintiffs can, the stockholders can bind each other and the corporation is also determined under internal affairs. Now, as I understand it, internal affairs started as a judicial, basically a jurisdictional bar. You had to sue in the state where the company was chartered or held property, and it's evolved as a choice of law principle. And I think he analyzed it just as LaBoyer did and just as Sonas did under Delaware law.
Well, it started out that way. But if you look at what this court said in McDermott versus Lewis, it said the internal affairs doctrine is more than a choice of law principle. It has constitutional dimensions. And then that's ultimately what the United States Supreme Court said in Cayman.
Correct. But to go back to Chief Justice's question, I think you have to do the analysis of collateral estoppel. Well, it would make no sense to just say, well, once you have another judgment somewhere else, we're just automatically barred. I think the second court needs to look and say, am I barred? What are the elements and how should they be determined? I think the court below looked at the same issue and decided under LaBoyer that that was something under California law. He didn't determine that that was an internal affair issue for the Delaware courts, but he did with respect to privity, given the relationships, given the dual nature of the derivative action. On the adequacy issue, I don't know if Your Honors had a particular question on adequacy or, again, because I think the King, I think that is an area of discretion. I think it's fact specific. I don't think there was any development of a bright line rule here. I don't think the court below said you always have to use 220, you always have to use 220 in Caremark. I think we can all agree, and if you look at footnote 23, and I've probably been in many of those cases. I know I was here on Goldman Sachs, here on Citigroup, other cases where the court said, we're not going to second guess a business judgment. This is a meritorious case. Nobody is second guessing a company's business judgment. This is a case that really goes to the board's failure to monitor illegal activity. Internal documents, strategic plans. This is an important case, and to have a case lost because other cases, 9-10 cases around the country, are determining that the shorthand for Delaware law is once you stand in the shoes of the company, you bind everyone. I mean, if you follow that to the most ridiculous conclusion, and I think Vice Chancellor Below noted it, he said, well, does that mean it bars the corporation? I don't know if it does or not, but if you wanted to follow that logic, you could see how somebody could conclude that. But I don't think there was any attempt for a bright line rule, even in Caremark. We've seen cases where people have come in and they've been able to show that a board is interested. You get over prong one of Aronson. You don't need a 220 for that. I don't think there's anything peculiar under the restatement, under Delaware law. Analysis are done 23.1 and 23 on the same basis. It's fact specific. Were you disloyal? Who drove the litigation, you or your lawyers? What did your complaint look like? Do you have a conflict of interest? Or you have an antagonism towards the company? There are all kinds of things. And I don't think this court has ever precluded a court below from using its discretion and its judgment in determining adequacy of a plaintiff. And I think if the court below in a representative case has actually a duty to do that, why wouldn't he have the same duty to look at a foreign plaintiff and say, all right, was this foreign plaintiff adequate? Because this plaintiff's activities and conduct is going to bar and preclude a meritorious case in Delaware.
Well, the answer to that is, isn't it, if the issue either wasn't raised or the issue was raised and decided by the district court in California, he's precluded from second-guessing it under the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution.
And the California court did not review for adequacy, is my understanding. There's been no finding by the federal court as to the adequacy of those plaintiffs out there. So you
and the inference to draw from that is that it either wasn't raised or there was no basis for raising the inadequacy of the plan.
Correct. And I don't know what it is.
We've come full circle back to the original question. Can the Delaware court introduce that into consideration here of the preclusive effect of the California case?
It can, because adequacy is an exception to collateral estoppel. And I think even Vice Chancellor Parsons in the career education case recognized that it's an absolute exception to it. And I want to address the waiver point, because there was a suggestion that somehow this was never raised, and that's not the case. And I can give your honors the page citations, because my friend Mr. Shepherd here directed some comments to the court below on pages 38 and 39 in response to Vice Chancellor Lasser's question on whether he had to find the California plaintiffs inadequate. And we stated, you don't have to find them inadequate in the sense of not being proficient. They're inadequate in the way they went about the litigation in the broader sense. They had whatever interests they had in mind. I don't know what they were. There is clearly an argument made on the adequacy of the California plaintiffs, and I think for the court to be hamstrung and not to be able to expand on that argument when it was fairly presented is a mistake. Our trial court should be able to have the discretion and the latitude to do that. And I think to have defendants come today and interpose it was waived. They saw the opinion. They could have gone in and said, wait a minute, we need an opportunity to address this. We had no idea you were going down this road. They could have moved for reconsideration. It's really not an issue on an interlocutory appeal. But the argument certainly wasn't.
Your point is that with regard to collateral estoppel, normally when a complaint's dismissed, the court's looking at a complaint. So the California court looked at the complaint and dismissed it. But there would be no reason for it to comment on the performance of counsel. It was simply looking at the complaint. Then when someone tries to invoke collateral estoppel in the second Delaware case, and the Delaware court has to decide whether it's going to apply the doctrine of collateral estoppel, one of the things the Delaware court has to say is, should I give what happened in California full faith and credit? And one of the things I have to look at is the adequacy of the representation that led to the California decision. And here, that was an alternative basis for the Vice Chancellor's decision.
Yes, precisely.
So he decided not to apply the California law on privity invoking the internal affairs doctrine, which we've talked about at length. But he also decided not to apply collateral estoppel due to his conclusion that the representation was inadequate.
Correct. And as we said, he didn't have to find that they were incompetent, they weren't proficient, but what they did is they showed from the outset that there were interests they were not serving other than the corporation. Had they used in the situation the 220, and ultimately, yes, they got the 220 documents, but I think that doesn't rehabilitate them. It doesn't turn somebody that's a faithless fiduciary into a faithful one by after the fact receipt of them. The point is the court looked, and I don't think this court has looked at the burden in this context in a derivative setting, but the court looked and said, I'm not satisfied, I'm not persuaded. This group of plaintiffs in California were representing the interests of the corporation. I believe that they were serving the interests of law firms that were filing on behalf of them.
So what is the constitutional rule that's in play in determining adequacy of representation, if any?
I don't think there is one. I saw in the briefs there was some due process and commerce rights that were being complained about, and I'm happy to have anybody take up my cause on plaintiffs' due process rights and commerce activities. But I think there was a suggestion that it was due process wasn't met because this presumption was there, a rebuttable presumption, and nobody was there to rebut the presumption. But in career education, Vice Chancellor Parsons looked at the California or whatever court it was, plaintiffs. They weren't there. They didn't come in to defend themselves. He looked at the record that was developed in that other jurisdiction. The record was developed by the defendants here and the California plaintiffs. Vice Chancellor Laster looked at the record. He didn't see anything that showed that they had done a meaningful, and in fact, what we have is a highly redacted complaint. We have no briefs on the motion to dismiss. They're totally under seal. We've complained about that. They weren't presented. So we don't know, and there was no proffer that they did anything that was meaningful. We know they didn't do 220 until after the fact. And there's no showing that their filing did anything to benefit the corporation. In fact, defendants complain that it caused parallel proceedings. That it was a burden.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Delaware plaintiffs put in their opposition to the collateral estoppel motion in their supplemental appendix at page B91 to 113. The court can read the entire thing. There's no mention of inadequacy in there. This came up only by the court. Inadequacy is an escape hatch. It always has been. There's a constitutional element, Justice Ridgely. It comes from Hansberry versus Lee. The due process clause says that if the first plaintiffs were antagonistic to the second plaintiffs, then the second plaintiffs are not bound. There's a prudential element, Justice Holland. It comes from the restatement and Sonus Networks, that if the first plaintiffs were so grossly deficient, then the second plaintiffs may not be bound. In either case, it is the second plaintiff's burden to make the argument and to make the record. What, there's another due process violation, by the way, in this case. We didn't brief this, but the board has a right to rest on that California judgment that's being deprived of. And the California law firm, who, of course, we don't represent, Vice Chancellor Laster adjudicated them to be in fiduciary breach of their obligations to this corporation without giving them notice or an opportunity to be heard on that question. There's also a Commerce Clause problem in regulating the conduct of foreign law firms from Delaware, as the Washington Legal Foundation points out in its brief. More importantly, though, on this adequacy question, it is the second plaintiff's burden. The second plaintiffs have to come in and show under either the constitutional standard of Hansberry or the grossly deficient standard of Sonus in the restatement. That showing was never made in this case. There's no evidence. There's no record. And the findings that Vice Chancellor Laster made don't meet up with either of those standards. He simply said, and this is in the transcript of page 78, it's a fast filer, is inadequate, full stop, period. That's a direct quote from Vice Chancellor Laster. He didn't have any other analysis. It was a fast filer. And it's a little rich for Ms. Tekelis to get up and complain about that when, of course, her client, the first filer, filed without a 220 demand. And as Vice Chancellor Laster said, he has never made a determination as to the adequacy of that plaintiff either. As to the full faith and credit issue, Chief Justice Steele, privity is not intertwined, we would submit, except in this sense. The question is whether the second court looks to the first court for all purposes, and the answer is yes. The great Chief Justice Marshall, had this to say about the full faith and credit clause 200 years ago. The doctrine, the judgment of a court should have the same credit, validity, and effect in every other court of the United States which it had in the state where it was pronounced, and that whatever pleas would be good to a suit thereon in such state and none others, could be pleaded in any other court in the United States. That's the Hampton versus McConnell case that's cited in our reply brief, Your Honor. The importance of that point is only those defenses that the plaintiffs could have raised in California would be good in Delaware, and this privity question, they could not have raised it in California. It was decided against them by LaBoyer. And LaBoyer, of course, didn't stand alone. It followed the Goldman case in the Ninth Circuit, which is binding precedent on the federal courts in California, and the long line of Sonus Networks and so forth. Justice Holland, we would submit there's no conflict in this case between the full faith and credit clause and the due process component of the internal affairs doctrine. Of course, the due process clause mandates application of the internal affairs doctrine where appropriate. No court has said so far that the internal affairs doctrine must be applied to the privity among shareholders. And the restatement, as I mentioned earlier, restatement second of conflicts of laws, section 94, comment B, says otherwise, and it goes through various examples in the comments to that section dealing with partnerships and other corporate entities without any suggestion that there's an internal affairs issue. However, If there were an internal affairs issue, we would submit there is no conflict. The Delaware Court of Chancery's rules recognize the privity among shareholders for this purpose. Rule 15 AAA, which Mr. Kellis mentioned, is unique in the American court system. There is no other provision of which I'm aware, it's not in the federal system, it's not in any other courts I've looked at from where these cases arise, says that a derivative suit may be dismissed with prejudice as to the named plaintiff only. That was adopted primarily to prevent serial amendments, but it also recognizes the necessary negative implication of that provision is, unless the court enters a 15 AAA order, then the dismissal is with prejudice to all shareholders, because otherwise that special provision as to the named plaintiff only would have been unnecessary. It exists only in Delaware. Delaware, of course, may give her judgments the scope and effect that Delaware has chosen. Delaware may not, however, adjudicate the effect of others. The Articles of Confederation, Your Honors, failed in part because the colonies would not respect each other's acts and judgments. One of the structural limitations, there were three main, the Due Process Clause, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Commerce Clause, and the Full Faith and Credit Clause, were included by the framers at the Constitutional Convention up the street precisely to address this problem, to ensure that a state would not refuse to give validity to the judgments of another state. And under general federal common law, as in the Simtek case, that applies equally to federal courts. And this court said so in the Iowa-Wisconsin case. Full faith and credit is the order of the day. Federalism, command, reversal required to enforce those constitutional structures that are so important to our federalism. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.